Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thanks for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foley, joined once again by Larfin Kempf and Nick Osello. Coach Kempf, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
I missed you last week.
Yeah, I missed you boys too. A lot to discuss. Incredible slate yesterday, and it feels as if, you know, the landscape is starting to take shape as we head deep into May here, with
March.
Well, just in the sense that 6 weeks until conference tournaments, whatever it may be, as we get closer to May, it feels as if like the competitive landscape is at least starting to show signs of who the seeded versus unseeded teams could be. Big East in particular, I thought was interesting today. But first and foremost, I just got to say Husker basketball, Sweet 16. I mean, there is no place like the Nebraska, man. It was special. Just a special, special day.
If we're airing out fanship, I'm really excited to support a English soccer team in the championship next year. Come on, you Spurs. And one comment about each of your alma maters, and then we're going to move on. Larkin, congratulations on winning the faux home tailgate 100-0 yesterday in Queens. Jamaica Queens, to be precise. And Nick, for those that are concerned about their ability to watch number one versus number two, Notre Dame versus Richmond on April 4th, it sounds like we might be getting some positive news on Monday.
Or what are you hinting at here, Terry?
Well, what do you think positive news about whether or not we're going to be able to watch the game would be?
Well, I have questions about that because we had a brief discussion and I'm curious. Now I'm just, oh, well, why didn't you let me know? If we had already had a discussion and you're saying, oh, expect news tomorrow, why didn't you keep me in the loop from the calls that I was having this morning about it? I mean, kind of a jerk move.
Because you were on the plane when I got my little...
How do we get a shuttle off the mic is the real question. He should be doing the color.
I'm with you.
And I'm with you guys on that. I'll fly to Chicago if I have to. And let me just say two things real quick. One, Terry, you said it, but I want to back up. Larkin, missed you last week. Two, for the loyal fans of this show, had a broadcast last night. Buffalo Bandits at San Diego Seals. San Diego, there's no other way to say it. They snatched defeat out of the jaws of victory this year in shocking ways. That being said, I was pretty preoccupied. My nickname right now is Zero Ball Knowledge, so I'm going to let Larkin and Terry run the ship and be kind of a comedic side court jester, if you will.
Well, we're recording a shade before 4 p.m. Eastern on Sunday, which means we just saw a pair of ACC wins over Big East opponents, which did not appear to be the way things were going to unfold as the first quarter of each game got underway. We'll start in Durham, where the Blue Devils fell behind 4-0 and emerged 8-7 victors over the Denver Pioneers. A big win for a team who had been maligned, criticized, choose your word, for the impotence is the only word that comes to mind, of their non-conference schedule, and it took a step up in competition. And that was kind of my takeaway for, well, first of all, it was the reason that I picked Denver in our staff picks. Just felt like it was going to take a minute for the Blue Devils to adjust to the strength and quality competition, whereas I was really impressed by Denver's resilience in their Monday night loss at home to Syracuse in terms of just kind of going toe-to-toe with the Orange. And I felt like that was going to be the difference in the game. It was certainly the difference in the first quarter, so I'm going to give myself a quarter point for that take. Larkin, what did you see from the Blue Devils in this win that was ultimately a pretty nice come from behind one?
It's a good question. I think I saw a defensive resilience. We've said it continuously. Duke has athletes, right? Are they as battle tested, you know, seven games into their slate as they traditionally are, and or as say someone who's played Princeton schedule? Of course not. But the reality of it is they still have like big, strong midfielders. I think that they're showing signs of life on the back end. I think the key call outs for me is, are they going to get enough saves, right, as they head into the next stretch of their schedule? Because just so everyone understands, I mean, it really is like a light switch where we're going from Cupcake City to, we're going to go at Cuse, UVA, Cornell neutral site, Notre Dame, UNC. So we're going to learn a lot about Duke here in the next five games. And I would still just put them in the bucket of we don't really know what we have. Like, I think Duke is good. I think they have a chance to be a lot better than that. But listen, it was, you know, 78 and sunny in Durham playing a team that has been, you know, statistically pretty average this year. Of course, a trap game. I think Matt Brown and Metsi are two of the best coaches in the business. I think Denver plays a very unique style that also has historically matched up well with Duke. Like, that Denver and Duke have played a lot of close games over the last decade. But I would still kind of just pause, take a breath, and say, I'm not sure we know enough about Duke yet to make really grandiose statements.
I think your point about will they get enough saves is the accurate one. If you're looking at the box score, 14 saves for Grayson Manning, who came in as the number one D1 leader in save percentage. Started slow, but ultimately ended up at 65% or whatever above his season average. And then at the other end of the field, Patrick Jameson credited with two saves. Now, I'm going to call that into question because he didn't get a save on the final play of the game in which Chase Bruno, with an opportunity to tie it with 11 seconds left coming out of a timeout, was deemed to have stepped in the crease. But to me, that was a save. You know, Jameson was big and definitely ate that shot, and Duke was able to clear it and kill the game. One of the things that I reacted more strongly to the other end of the field, and maybe it was just because I was reacting more to specifically the start of the game. And it was Denver's defense. And I think as Georgetown looks beatable in ways that maybe they haven't in prior years, one of the storylines that we're going to follow in late April and early May is whether or not their Big East dominance comes to an end. And if it does, it very likely will be at the hands of a Pioneer team that, quite frankly, I didn't think was going to be very good in the preseason and have been roundly impressed. And one of the reasons is because this defense has played so well. Obviously, they're getting a lot of saves, and so I'm not here to dispute that. But the thing that stood out the most to me, they blocked 5 shots in the first quarter, including 3 consecutive shots in one sequence. They looked like a hockey team. And to me, that's so much credit for the way that John Gallant has this team playing. You know, they are both in a lot of zone, and also when they're not in zone, they're very packed in and they're man-to-man set. So basically just clogging shooting lanes. And I think that's one of the reasons that Manning is actually saving at such a high percentage, because you put shooters into a position where they're like, I'm either going to hit somebody or miss the cage. So I just have to get this to the goal. And then as a result, you're giving the goalie a few more meatballs that he's going to be able to eat up. And to me, that seems like a pretty good defensive philosophy, and certainly one that's working for the Pios.
Well, and I was going to make that point about Denver, because historically, if you watch how Canada and our brethren up to the north have influenced the field game in particular, the low-hanging fruit is the SportsCenter top 10 behind the back around the world, you know, wizardry on offense. But I think this could be the first year where you're making a case that the Canadian box style defense of clogging lanes and just making shooters take difficult shots. I think the second compounding effect from that is it gives the goalie consistent looks. You know, the negative aspect, oh yeah, he might have guys in front of him, so he can't get a true read on the shot. But if you get enough reps of any shot, like, you're going to get, you know, marginally better with every save that you make. So even just looking at DU's schedule, you know, they've held, you know, they started off holding Cleveland State to 1, Air Force to 2, Utah to 7. And then in their last 3 games, Ohio State to 6 goals, Syracuse to 13, not great, but a 1-goal game. And then another 1-goal game against Duke, holding what we could classify a potent offense to 8 goals. So, you know, this could be a very great case study for how do we implement more box tactics into the field game. And Larkin, having played with Canadians, you know, they're psychos. You know, they don't mind getting in those shooting lanes, soaking shots. And it's akin to prepping for Navy in football. You know, how many times are you going to see the triple option? You're not going to be good because you only prep for 1 week of that. How good can you play against DU's defense? You know, probably not great, because it's the only time that you're going to see that, you know, the entire year.
I think there'll be a very popular upset pick this week. They have Georgetown at Paul Barton, right? It's in Denver.
Peter Barton, sorry.
One of the most unique home field advantages in the sport.
Biblical mistake there.
If you watch the last, you know, the first 45 minutes of that Cuse game today against Georgetown, I'm not sure how you can't pick a trending Denver team at home to at least be competitive. But we'll see.
Well, let's go to that game right now. So Syracuse, 18-12 victors over Georgetown in the Dome. As you mentioned, getting ready to shift into BE's play. We talked about this last week in the context of Richmond insofar as, you know, similar type of situation, right? A-10 and Big East are they're right in the meaty part of the mid-major section of lacrosse, right? If you're going to have, if you've got 11 conferences, your high majors are the top three, right? So it's ACC, Big Ten, and Ivy. Your mid-majors are the next three or four, depending on where you want to draw the line between mid-major and low-major. And you're definitely going to include the A-10, the Big East, the Patriot League. And then we can have conversations about the CAA versus the America East or whatever the case might be. And so the point is, as Big East play gets started, and you know, we'll talk about this a little bit in the context of Richmond's win over UMass. We touched on that briefly. It kind of represents the opposite of what we just talked about in Duke, and especially for two teams that have, you know, packed their non-conference schedule with loaded competition. You know, Georgetown 3-4 coming off of a midweek win over Loyola, kind of felt like a let's get through it game for both teams. It was rescheduled from January 31st. Loyola has their sights squarely set on the Patriot League, and they had a game against Bucknell that they needed to get this weekend. So, you know, they rested a couple of guys that were injured, and you know, it felt like Georgetown was able to separate in the second quarter and cruise in the second half in what was a pretty cold game. So now they go up to the Dome. I guess if this is any indication as to how Georgetown was treating it, Kevin Warren wore duck boots on the sideline at Loyola on Tuesday, and he wore, what would you call it? A throwback short sleeve Georgetown basketball warm-up that had Hoyas in vertical letters down the side and the number, I believe it was 34 on the sleeve. So suited and booted, ready to play. And his team was not. Well, essentially, that's not true. They did jump out to a 3-1 lead, but then the Orange responded in impressive fashion. Joey Spolina finished with 2 goals and 4 assists. Michael Leo finished with 5 goals, playing attack. You know, just to pause on that for a second, it was definitely one of the big topics coming into the season after Trey Deer's injury was who was likely to fill that left-handed attack spot. And it fluctuated a bit early in the season between Leo and Peyton Anderson. Anderson did play, according to the commentators, on a couple of the early runs. So I wasn't sure whether or not he was playing. And then he scored right-handed on the alley. And I was like, that's the midfielder Peyton Anderson that I've always seen, and why I felt like it made more sense for him to fill that spot. And now, coming off of a couple of high scoring games, we've got what appears to be solidity with Michael Leo on the left side and Finn Thompson on the right side. Larkin, you were already going on it, so I'll let you continue. Thoughts on Case Georgetown?
I think it's a lot of themes that we've referenced this year, which is Cuse and their speed and athleticism at home is a bear. Like they come at you in waves. There's something about that midfield group where they literally look more athletic in upstate New York. And I think the big call out, which is somewhat hard to quantify, but like without the Connor brothers, the two Colgate transfers, I'm not sure how much this Georgetown roster had. Like I think they're materially worse on the back end this year than they have been. Like I know Ty Banks is a good player, but I just don't know if their connectivity, the way in which they slide and recover, if they're protecting Anderson Moore, who I believe is their keeper, as well as in years past. And it just feels as if the group is trending the wrong way. But I'd also want to give Cuse credit. They've really steadied the ship. Like since I've last spoke with you guys, I think they've rattled off 4 or 5 straight against quality opponents, right? Beating Hop, you know, taking that tough road trip to Air Force in Denver, which is, you know, irrelevant to where they sit in the RPI. That's a hard place to fly to with the altitude variable. And now getting a big win at home. So listen, Cuse is 7-2. You know, I'm sure their fans, you know, a subset of that fan base wants more. But the reality is, like, they continue to plow along in the direction of a tournament berth with a decent resume. So now it's just a question of, listen, ACC play. Can they find a way to beat a Notre Dame or UNC this year? And I think we're all just going to kind of pause and wait and see. I don't know yet. But definitely a fun matchup, you know, fast and furious. I also just want to say their goalie got flagged for what was like lowering his shoulder
And they ended up calling it on 11, giving him a 30-second push, even though he, like, didn't make contact. I don't know what the refs are doing. There's something about the dome where, like, the flags are just way too involved. And, yeah.
Well, it might be the fact that, like, half the refs are from the Central New York region.
Such a bizarre sequence, right? It's like, I think it was Connor, like, it, you know, beats him underneath. The goalie comes into it. He just starts, like, throwing laundry everywhere. And then on the far side, Dwan ends up taking a shot. Georgetown clearly has the backup, and they give Spelina the backup. I was like, wow, okay. This is really just getting weird.
I want to jump in on your comment about they have a pretty good resume. They have an excellent resume. They are number 3 in RPI, number 2 in strength of schedule, and they are 4-2 against top 20 teams. Now, they do not have a top 5 win, whereas Princeton has 2, and they have 1 top 10 win. So really, they're being bolstered by that 11-20 range, which, you know, can feel a little paper tiger-ish, but ultimately is super useful on Selection Sunday. We see it all the time, and it's only going to get better, right, based on where their future opponents currently sit.
The biggest risk factor to their resume is if Harvard gets clipped by Princeton and Cornell in the Ivy, and then Harvard starts to leak in the direction of 10-20. But you're right. Right now, it's lock solid.
Well, I mean, it doesn't matter until they fall outside of the top 20, and then it becomes a bad loss. So, you know, I agree with you, but at the same time, you know, right now they're still undefeated. Nick, you got anything to say about Syracuse? Did you see this Chuck Kaczynski hit that he got ejected for?
Yeah. Yeah. And
that was a proto Nick Acello one.
Oh, oh. And that was funny because I gave up Instagram for Lent as well. That one's actually been steady. What did you give up for Lent? Apparently drinking. So that one was sent to me and I got a text being like, yo, like, did you see this? I DM'd you. And I go, no, I didn't. So I had to watch it on an Instagram web browser, which is always a terrible experience, but it was one of my favorite plays this year. Put it on SportsCenter top 10. But Larkin, you made the point about Denver that the result of the Denver game didn't exactly, you know, provide a lot of clarity with where they stand. That to me was this game. You know, I think Cuse is great, not excellent, given their two blemishes. I think Georgetown is good, not great. And this was one of the few games that I'm like, this is kind of exactly where I expected it to be. Cuse at home with an explosive offense and Georgetown just going to be overpowered. So I didn't have anything crazy to take away from this game other than Chuck Kaczynski, consider yourself a fan of mine. Should you be fortunate enough, we need to start the inside lacrosse, like big hit, like if it happens in the PLL or the NLL and someone gets fined, like the Ocello fund to cover those fines. Cause I hate seeing him get ejected for it.
I like the idea of if you get a 3-minute non-releasable, you just get a Venmo from Nick Ocello from Idaho.
Yeah. The 3-minute non-releasable fund. Yeah. NIL deal.
That's a good idea.
I want to shift up the order here a little bit because we were originally going to talk about Cornell Princeton next and then Ohio State Rutgers after that before you were going to get to Penn State Maryland. But I want to move Penn State Maryland up now so that we can talk about Maryland and Georgetown in context of each other, because I think that the question that I have is, why does it feel like we're treating Maryland one way and Georgetown not the same way? And maybe there are some obvious answers there, but I want to drill down on it a little bit. So, there are a lot of one-sided series in college lacrosse, and some of them are surprising. But one that is kind of hilariously so is Penn State Maryland, because they don't agree on the number of times they've played. I believe Maryland thinks or argues that the series started in 1926 or 8, somewhere in that range, whereas Penn State says that it started in 1916, which means that the Nittany Lions claim that yesterday's 10-6 victory over the Terrapins was their fourth all-time. Maryland, we contend it is just their third out of, I believe, 46 chances. It's hard to keep straight which kind of numbers look like either direction. This is a little bit of a game of runs. Penn State got out to a 2-0 lead in the whiteout in Panzer Stadium. Thank you, Big Ten Network, for starting this game later in the afternoon so that it was in a spotlight pretty much all its own. Terps responded with two, made it 2-2. And then Penn State scored five straight over the course of the second half of the first quarter and through the early part of the second. Scoring died down for about 10 minutes, and then AJ Larkin got one back to make it 7-3 at half. Very quiet third quarter. Chris Lyons, the only goal. And then Terps scored twice to start the fourth, cut the Mini Lions lead to 7-6 before ultimately Penn State scored the last three to seal the game. I was kind of split screening Colgate versus BU when Maryland was making their runs. So when I say it never felt like this game was in doubt, take that for what it's worth, because I wasn't really paying attention. But, you know, talking to the rest of the Inside Lacrosse staff, monitoring the conversation on social media, I do think that is a fair assessment, because Penn State was able to respond so quickly to that goal that cut it within one. And so here we are, Maryland, you know, you can kind of react to both sides of this. I was listening to the D-Fly and Dixie podcast, and Dan Abern called Penn State mysterious or surprising, hard to pin down, because they can win and lose seemingly to anybody. And with all respect to Dan and that point, like, I just don't see it that way. To me, that is like exactly what you would expect out of a young team, and especially a young team with a freshman goalie who is inconsistent, and especially a team like with those features, but also Hunter Aquino, who we think is supposed to be their centerpiece offensively, now has missed the last three games. With that being said, you know, the losing to Navy did not come with, or Villanova, with Aquino out of the lineup. I think that the more, if not interesting, then important discussion for this result is to talk about a now 3-4 Maryland team who sits at number 23 in the RPI. And, you know, you're talking about a program that's never had a losing season. So with the Dan Oresti report that Will Schaller is done for the year, which I think is also, I also think is true, and what that means for their ability to play defense at the level that the Maryland fans have come to expect, I don't think that was the side of the ball that was the reason for this outcome. I do think that they were disorganized early, but that they buttoned it up as the game went along. It was more so the issue that they couldn't put the ball in the back of the net, despite Eric Spanos returning from injury for the first time in a month. Larkin, your thoughts?
I agree with a lot of what you just said towards the tail end of that. Like, the truth of this is, it feels uncomfortable as a nation, right? We're just so used to Maryland at the top of the table and in the top 5-10 in RPI. But, like, I think, you know, this podcast,
as a nation, just so good. So good.
I can't make a politics joke.
Republic. No, I really mean it. I mean, I do want to pat ourselves on the back. We get a lot of things wrong, but the eye test of the Maryland offense in the dome in week one or whenever it was, we kind of called out then, and it remains now, which is the most dynamic dodger on this team is a righty half wall shooter who did not dodge in the Ivy League. That is really strange. And, you know, I think 27 in black is like as good and as complete a defender as has played in the last like 5-10 years. Like, he's just rock solid. So when you think about his leadership loss, when you think about in compared to their normal, their standard, their goaltending this year has been just okay, right? Typically they're like first team All-American. So now they become like a matchup nightmare. Like, no one wants to play Maryland with like a losing record in the Big Ten quarterfinals, right? And am I gonna like fly to Vegas and put money down against John Tillman? Of course not, but you know, clearly this team is continuing to struggle and really has no answers. I think Penn State, as kind of a follow-up to that and adjacency, I think many people would be surprised how low Penn State is in the RPI. I don't think people realize that their losses to Villanova and Navy have effectively like put them into a different tier of math that makes them just like really hard to pencil into like where they fit in the May conversation, because we could easily be in a scenario where it feels as if Penn State's resume is really good, but like if they don't, you know, take care of business the rest of the way, like they could easily be a bubble out, if not even considered. And I think that would shock people. Like, I think because of the Princeton result, and because of how they've handled business in like the big matchups, right? The reality of this, you know, we're going to talk about it every week because of how
different it feels than the Maryland norm. But the truth of it is like, I think the offense is just okay. And can they win like 6-5 in OT against someone? Yes, they can. But perhaps the result against Virginia in a back and forth affair is exactly what it looked like, which is like two just okay teams this year playing back and forth. So yeah, I'll pause.
Larkin, to your point, and this is how my brain works. I think a lot of people are saying, well, they did lose to Villanova and Navy, but they beat Princeton and Cornell. So ultimately it's a wash and we can just move forward from that. That is not the case. And I would be more scared of playing a Penn State team than a Maryland team. The most interesting thing that I've seen in watching Maryland this season is, in contrast to what we talk about with Duke, which is they just have freak athletes and like the puzzle pieces will fall however they fall. I'm watching Maryland going, I don't know where you put the six guys on offense. I don't know what sets you can run, how you can adjust that to where there's a level of success that you would expect from the Terps. I don't think there's, you know, the Tillman shuffling. I don't think they have the roster that will allow Tillman to you know, prove how good of a coach he actually is. And then on the flip side, I just have no clue about Penn State. You know, the best result for Penn State, I think, you know, I really started putting a lot of respect in that 10-8 loss to Carolina. You blow the doors off Cornell. You play a top three team, you know, kind of down to the wire. You take care of business against Maryland. You know, I think they're building some real momentum. And their two blemishes might, you know, might eliminate them from serious conversations. I don't know. All I know is, you know, this Maryland team, if I were a Maryland fan, I would already be finding a way to try and get excited about 27. Like, that's where I'm at with it.
Just to double down on that. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you. Larkin.
We just love apples, man. We love passing back and forth. I think they have to win out the rest of the way, right? Like, they have to go to Columbus this weekend and probably win.
Penn State or Maryland?
Penn State.
It's funny because just for those that haven't heard me give this spiel before, the RPI is a relatively simple formula, and 50% of it is your opponent's record. So they're going to play 8-1 Ohio State. Their RPI is almost certainly going to improve regardless of the result. They also have a 6-2 Johns Hopkins on their schedule. So those are two very appealing opponents left for them to play. They also have a 3-6 Michigan and then Rutgers, who's 7-3. So like, they actually are in a better spot in terms of the record of their opponents relative to the RPIs of their opponents, in terms of their own RPI getting a little bit better. But this could be a nice edge because theirs is 14 right now, which I would say, dating back to 2008, is probably out. So that's 20, let's call it 17 tournaments. It's probably out 10-7, somewhere in that range. So they're like right on the cut line. And what that means is that they probably need to climb 1, 2, maybe 3 spots in order to feel good if they don't win the Big Ten AQ. And legitimately, what determines that could be, do they get lucky and play, you know, call it Ohio's or Hopkins in the Big Ten quarters and Ohio State in the semis, and then lose to whomever in the championship, as opposed to then on the flip side playing Michigan in the quarters and then Maryland in the semis, which just be a virtue of the records and how important that is, could be the difference in terms of what their RPI looks like.
Yeah, agreed.
So like I said,
stupid.
I wanted to
RPI is stupid.
It is, but it's our stupid, Nick. The point about Georgetown and Maryland. So I had Maryland as my number one team in the preseason. I moved Georgetown up to number either 5 or 6 after having them lower. And the reason I had them lower is because, you know, my concern was when you looked at what they brought back relative to what they lost, I didn't want to underreact to the role that Fulton Bayman and Aiden Carroll played. And my notion was that, you know, if you routinely import your offense, and in this instance, Roy and Liam Connor, there are just a lot of threats to the locker room. And that was my concern, like, kind of all through the fall. And then Georgetown, it just, like, steamrolls through the scrimmage schedule, and all the reports out of, or conversations out of their locker room was that, no, it hadn't disrupted things, and everybody was feeling really good about it. So that was why, you know, in between where, you know, maybe I had it in the way too early in the fall relative to where I had it in January, you know, moved them up a few spots. And the reason I bring it up is because, you know, they are similar on paper insofar as, you know, they had their, their equally relatively high preseason expectations. They both brought in two starting level attackmen as transfers, and they're both 3-4. And maybe the answer is it's as simple as historic expectations for the program, but we're talking about Maryland in the context of worst season in program history. And we're talking about Georgetown in the context of, can they turn it around and right the ship? And I'm just curious as to, like, your guys' thoughts on why those are the respective narratives for each team. And if it's,
I think,
deserved.
That answer is quite simple, and it's the variance and difficulty of league play and their AQ. If Georgetown was not in the Big East and still and did not have a very reasonable path to be favored in all of their league games and still win their league tournament, I think it would be a dumpster fire conversation as well. So I think it's, like, the truth is the Big Ten is just quite good, right? And it's, as you watch Maryland continue to search for answers, you know, they're losing All-American defenders, blah, blah, blah. Their best players are their pole, right? It's like, how are they going to fly to Columbus in the Big Ten tournament and realistically score more than 10 goals to win the game? I think that's why people are jumping to that conclusion. But
giving Georgetown the benefit of the doubt that their entire season is right in front of them, because all they need to do is take care of business in their conference.
Yeah, like, today, honestly, was a very good fishbowl of, like, what is the actual risk to Georgetown's season, which is Denver gets better. Like, Denver ends up being, you know, the Matt Brown offense that we know is somewhere in there. Like, there's always the fear that Denver wakes up. Like, they're not scoring at a high level this year, but they have historically, and they're very well coached. So it's, I really do think that's what it is, but I think you're right to put them in the same bucket of, they just lost a little bit of their identity. Both of them have, like, Kevin Warren to me is a defense first educator who coaches elite short 60 midfield play. Like, you can't clip the game today up at the Dome and say that was elite short 60 midfield play. Like, they were getting blown by both directions in phone booths. Not being doormen, not feeding slides with fills, not being, like, super active and protecting their goaltender. So, and conversely at Maryland, like, if you're going to hang your hat on something, it's like, okay, there's an athlete in that locker room every year who can trigger an offensive possession and get the defense moving. And this year, like, bizarrely, they don't have one. And it's been a long, long time since that's really been the case.
And to that point, one of the things that's always been most interesting about them is their ability to have that guy be not the player you would least expect, but not the guy who in many years garners the most attention, right? So I'm thinking about Keegan Conn and Anthony DeMeo and how important they were in triggering the offense in a year that Logan Wisnauskas won the Thornton, right? Obviously, you've got your Jesse Bernhardt teams and you know, they were heliocentric in ways that are relatively, you know, kind of uncommon. But then, as we saw in 2023, when a lot was put on Spanos and Braden Erbs' shoulders, those guys were young and didn't necessarily have the full skill set in order to be able to avoid a first round upset against Army. In the intervening years, it was the multiplicity of options that, whether it was matchup dependence, and you could turn to a guy like Zach Whittier, you know, at one point that Mark Dixon made on that podcast that I referenced was, we still haven't seen from Jack Schultz what we saw from him last year. And so, to your point, Larkin, like, it may not be that there isn't an athlete in the locker room. It may be that he's there, but for whatever reason, he's just either not available or not playing as well as he's shown the ability to play in the past.
Yeah, well said. Last thing I'll say, the nation is praying. The coaching community is literally praying that Maryland does not wake up here and back into the Big Ten tournament.
Totally.
Like, it would be a literal nightmare for Jerry Byrne if he's, like, the number two overall seed and he gets Maryland at home in the first round. Like, Agreed. That is, yeah. So, We'll see.
Nick, can you give us your thoughts on the nation and what it's praying for?
Oh, God. That's, I should probably just decline to answer. Lower gas prices, we'll call it.
Let's stick in the Big Ten. The Ohio State Buckeyes went to SHI Stadium, I believe is what it's called, and emerged 6-5 overtime victors over Rutgers. This was my, I don't want to call it my favorite game of the weekend because Carolina Army was awesome. Colgate BU was also awesome. It was the game that I was the most dialed into and probably the game that I can say the most about because spoke to Nick Myers after, wrote the game story, and there were just a lot of subplots and storylines, I guess you would say. So the first is 6-5 game. Not a shock. This was the first over-under game total of the year south of 20 that I saw. It was 19.5. It obviously went way under. And that's because Carden Stoller and Caleb Fiok are two of the best goalies in the country. And so when they play against each other, you're going to expect there to be not a ton of goals. Well, it turns out that Caleb Fiok got dinged in pregame warmups. And after playing, like, call it 22 minutes, made two saves, let in the third goal. Ohio State called timeout, and he told Nick he needed a sub. He just didn't have it due to the injury. And so on comes Jack Allen, a native of Cambridge, England, who went to the Hill Academy. Nick saw him for the first time in the U-20s in, I guess it would have been the summer of 22, might have been 23, in Limerick, Ireland. And it turns out also that Allen has connections to Ohio because I think his parents were professors at OU before they went to Cambridge. And so he comes on in relief and unbelievable statistical performance. 10 saves, 2 goals allowed. And one of the plays that I saw that really stood out to me was coming out of the crease to pick up a ground ball and turn possession. It was really more of an interception than it was a ground ball with about 6 minutes to go. That felt really pivotal. But with that being said, he could have won it on his own because he came in and you know, it was like not a save opportunity because Ohio State was trailing. So ultimately, it was Khalif Hocker who, in and of himself, really interesting story. I wrote a profile about him last spring, I think, that was basically making the argument that he's kind of, I always use Sean Marion and Amari Stoudemire as my examples for this because, you know, when people talk about how, like, if our best athletes played soccer, we would win the World Cup every year. And I just, I think Sean Marion would have been the best soccer goalie of all time. Well, it feels like for 20 years, people have been saying, like, as soon as, you know, the West Coast and Midwest athletes, I guess we have one example of this on the podcast right now. Even though I'm from the Midwest, I'm not the athlete that people talk about when they talk about the corn-fed white boys. But as soon as they start playing lacrosse, like, the game's going to change and whatever else. So Khalif Hocker, the son of a college basketball player and a college runner, I think she was a sprinter, started focused on lacrosse when he was in third grade and from Cincinnati and just has been kind of on the radar all through the recruiting process. And we ended up ranking him number 15 in the class of 25, but he tore his ACL last April and didn't play. I believe he didn't play, almost positive, in Ohio State's opener. So I kind of assumed that he was going to redshirt. Turns out he got cleared in January. I believe made his debut in their second game and is just starting to come on. So natural attackman, righty, but he's running out of the box and down 2 goals. So I believe it was 5-3 with about 8 minutes to go in the fourth. He was ISO'd on a shorty. Below GLE left, kind of like an S dodge, gets underneath and then got a little lucky. His shot hit Stoller in the chest. It bounced up, but like went nestled right underneath the crossbar. So that cut it to 1. And then with, I want to say like 3 minutes to go, was basically the caddy corner position on the field, high to the goalie's right. And again, splits, this time goes topside. My favorite part of this move is that he throws a stick fake that throws both one. It would have been the wrong slider. It was the adjacent slider, but a guy that hedged off to him and the guy he beat, both of them were frozen. The slide man came. He dodged that guy, turned, ready jump shot. This time overpowered Stoller, hit him in the stick, but it also bounced in and tied the game at five. He then got the ball twice down the stretch in order to try to win the game. Deferred in both instances, generated good looks. Ohio State did not convert. And then, as these things almost always do, and shout out to Rick Mercurio on the broadcast for pointing this out, what was otherwise a game that averaged a goal every 6 minutes ended 9 seconds into overtime after Jack Oldman won the opening faceoff. Dominic Shaw picked up the ground ball, got it to Alex Marinier, and he hammered the ready step down from the point of the fast break. 6-5 Buckeyes. Larkin, your thoughts?
I mean, it was a rock fight. I think my thoughts are Ohio State, for whatever reason, has this ability, and it works both directions, positive and negative, but to really suck people in to like old school chess matches. Like, Nick Myers was built in a lab for the pre-shot clock era. Like, that's how his brain works, in my opinion. You know, you could argue Kevin Corrigan as well, but both have had to adapt. But listen, they're rock solid. I thought this was one Rutgers could steal heading in. You know, listen, it's not my cup of tea. Obviously, I like getting up and down. But I think there's also, you know, you ask the key question where it's like, do we really think Ohio State is going to, like, blow the wheels off Maryland if they play them in the quarterfinal, as an example, in the Big Ten? So, I Ohio State's 8-1. Their actual wins are good, not elite. I actually think their best film is against Notre Dame, right? They showed quite well against Notre Dame. And, you know, they're in a very strong position, but I would put them in the bucket of we need to see more out of their offensive depth and specifically in terms of like dynamic dodging to feel comfortable about, you know, heading into like a quarterfinal type matchup. So I label them as like wait and see. Like, I just don't know enough about them other than their back end. But listen, anytime you have a backup goalie come in and put up hockey statistics, clearly that says a ton about their defensive identity. Like, they give up the looks they want to. They're hyper-competitive on knowing the scout and trying to force teams to beat them in different ways. And they deserve a ton of credit for that. So they're in a great spot.
I got to say, you know, we saw it against Notre Dame, but I have Notre Dame 1A, like Ohio State 1B for the types of games that they play. And there is a razor thin margin. So no, Ohio State is not built to blow the brakes off of anybody. But in those games, you know, just looking at their last couple games, let me just pull up their schedule right quick. 1-goal win over Rutgers, 2-goal win over DU, 1-goal loss to Notre Dame, 1-goal win over Georgetown. Like, their script is already written on how they're going to go deep. And what I thought was most interesting in reading the IL article, it was Nick Myers talking about Hawker. He's dodging, but not dodging, you know, hey, I'm a freshman. I'm blowing the brakes off of my matchups, but I don't want to be the guy who shoots it early in a possession or just, you know, dodges and shoots without looking. And Coach Myers was like, hey, when it's crunch time, just do that. Like, just commit to it. And I think that, like, I think this was the first real separating X factor from an Ohio State offensive standpoint. And it made me a little bit more scared of the Buckeyes. And I think every team should be scared of the Buckeyes. You're going to be in a 1-goal game, and now they have a guy who you're going to have to slide to. I don't see how there's a defender in the country that's going to stop him with his change of direction and elite athleticism. Terry, that goal that he scored when he started kind of down low, the S dodge, it was Michael Sowers-esque separation in, you know, 3 yards and one jab step. So really, really fun player to watch. And I'm going to be tuning into more Ohio State games because of him.
The thing I want to shout out with respect to this Ohio State season is that they've already accomplished something that you could argue has never happened in Nick Myers' tenure, which is putting together back-to-back good seasons. And I think the best illustration of this was 2017 and 18. In 2017, they went 16-5, lost in the national championship game. Hard to have a better season with the exception of, you know, one result. And then the following year, they went 8-7. And it's a function of a lot of different factors, some of which I you can't even know if you haven't been in the locker room the whole time. But the point is that there was a contingent of Ohio State fans and detractors who looked at their success in 2025 and said, all right, I'm going against the Buckeyes in 26. And with this 8-1 start, you know, of course, I suppose it's possible for the floor to fall out of this thing. But I would bet against it. I don't see that happening for a variety of reasons. And that's before you even take into account the fact that we're making a big deal out of Will Schuller's absence. Well, Ohio State's had to deal with the absence of Bobby Van Buren the entire season. Not to mention, they also have been dealing with Blake Island, who's their number one short stick D-Mitty, the last couple of games as well. So shout out to the Buckeyes. In my opinion, they're for real. Nick, when you said 1A, 1B, Notre Dame, Ohio State, I thought maybe you were saying that in terms of the top of an inside lacrosse media poll vote, which, you know, might seem a little aggressive to some, but I would say more and more is shaping up like a realistic option. Although Larkin's comments about that are fair as well. And certainly, obviously, we've got a couple of contending teams at the top of the list, too.
Not top two, but I would put them 5 at the lowest. They're scary.
Let's talk about Cornell Princeton. I know, Larkin, this was a game that you've got a lot of thoughts on. Obviously, the Tigers were a team that was receiving number one votes. They were coming in winners of 5 straight games. And this was just a really... Well, let me just cede the floor to you. Just in terms of the nuts and bolts, Cornell wins 13-11. What was this game? Because I don't feel like I fully have my arms around it, but I do have a couple of particular anecdotes that I would like to, or points that I would like to make, but I don't think I have as much breadth as you do.
Yeah, so just for a little bit of background, like Cornell, I believe this is their 7th straight over Princeton. Culturally, they, for whatever reason, have like this game circled. Obviously, they're traditional rivals, but I think that stat would shock people just when you consider the talent of the last, let's call it, 10 years of Princeton lacrosse dodging. You know, the truth of it is I think that everybody reset their expectations on Cornell after the Penn State result, right? They then beat the brakes off of Brown. I was there, overhand rights to the chin, but when you consider the quality of our group this year and like, you know, hopefully we're trending, but we haven't done it recently. I think no one really learned too much, unfortunately, and not to chirp myself, but listen, it was a great result. I think the big thing I took away when you watch back the highlights is this game was extremely competitive and I just felt like Firth and Goldstein elevated. And, you know, the defensive matchups on Palumbo and on Kabiri, right? It really is as simple as that. Like, I thought 51 outplayed 2. I, Larkin, picked Nate Kabiri to be a Toroton finalist this year. Like, I think he's really good. I thought he got outplayed at home by his counterparties, let's call it. And, you know, I think what was surprising was the way in which Cornell's athleticism at short stick D mid seemed to hold up on Princeton's downhill dodging. Now, I think one of the key questions would be, you know, is the absence of Pete Bonanno real? And like, is the depth not as good as some people think it is at Princeton? But heading into this matchup, that was not the way in which I thought they'd lose. I didn't think that they wouldn't be able to score, if that makes any sense. But I still think Princeton's A, tested, B, incredibly good. The Ivy's always a little bit wacky where like good teams lose games. It's very rare to go 6-0 in the Ivy. So I think Princeton and Cornell will be there at the end of the year, you know, in an Ivy tournament type matchup. And I think what gets very, very fascinating is, can Cornell translate this momentum into the rest of the Ivy slate? Like, can they hold serve against a Harvard or a Penn or a Yale, or do they get clipped again? But the last thing I'll say is tournament success breeds swagger and it breeds belief. And like, they're the reigning national champions. Like, they're not going to talk themselves out of hope. So especially when you got a guy sitting at the front of the bus who's like as fit as anyone on the bus, right? Like, he's a young guy who could still run by a pole, right? So, you know, Cornell's a problem, and that's a huge win. And that's a win that will really pencil come Selection Sunday, because I think we all agree that Princeton will be right there.
So watching, my main takeaway was how impressed I was by Cornell's defensive effort, particularly when the ball would hit the ground in the offensive zone. It just felt like there were two guys flying to the ball for Cornell where there was only one Tiger. Looking at the box score, one thing that stands out is Cornell 22 of 22 clearing. And not for any particular reason other than the theme of Matt Kiener's post-game story coming away from Connor's comments was that they had grown up. And I feel like there's a measure of protecting the ball that manifests in being perfect on clears, especially when it doesn't continue into turnovers. They actually committed six more turnovers than Princeton did. What that means to me, how I interpret that, is we are fully buttoned up in the clear. Now, granted, I will concede that some of these were probably like early possession, right? So they effectively are fake successful clears, but even still, like, that's not going to be enough to fully undermine the point. The confidence that you get, not just from clearing fully successfully, but also being plus six in saves, you know, especially given the shine that Ryan Craddock has gotten over the last month or so based on some of the performance that he had. I will point or remind folks that early on in the season, that wasn't the case. It makes you feel a little bit more comfortable throwing aggressive skip passes or committing the types of turnovers that, especially for a team that we know what their knowns are and we know what their unknowns need to be, like roughly where they are now and where they need to get to, especially in the absence of AJ Nicklick. And so all of that is justification for throwing those aggressive skip passes for a variety of reasons. Number one, because like those are how your playmakers make plays. And not only that, but also they generally tend to yield like better, easier looks for guys who need to build their own confidence in a game in front of 2,500 fans in a sunwashed Saturday afternoon game against a league opponent that you have dominated, right? The last thing that I'll say is for all of this to happen without what you could argue would have been Cornell's number one weapon in this game, which is Jack Escadden, and to get a good serviceable performance from Michael Mekonnen as the backup faceoff guy was even more impressive. So again, you know, if I'm a Cornell fan, I am as ecstatic as I think I could have possibly been, because this is a Cornell blueprint win. This is not Ryan Goldstein and Willem Firth put on their capes and won a game for us, even though both those guys should be pleased with their performances. This is like the DNA of the Gorges manifesting in Central Jersey, and that's what this program cares the most about.
Yeah, I like that take. And then the only thing that I'll contribute here is my opinion that I want you guys to tell me if I'm right or wrong. I'm curious if I over-indexed Princeton a little bit too much and kind of had them at one or two. I look at their last two games and, you know, regardless of where you land on Yale, an 11-10 victory in New Haven, not easy, but, you know, if you're Princeton elite, hey, maybe we should have won that game by five. Now we drop one to Cornell and we're looking, essentially a bye week against Brown. And, you know, after that, looking at the rest of the Ivies, you know, did I over-index Princeton and think in their top three?
My pushback would be this. We just talked about the Rutgers-Ohio State result. If you watch the first 30 minutes of Princeton dismantling Rutgers defense 2 weeks ago, I don't think the takeaway is like, you know, we're overthinking the ceiling on Princeton. Like, they were dominant and
unbelievable.
I think it more speaks to one of the really unique natures in our sport, which is like league play and coaching comfortability. Like, these are two staffs that know each other incredibly well. There's a ton of longevity on both staffs. So the coordinator and the matchup planning, you know, it's not done in a week. It's done over like a decade. Like, they know a ton about how Mitch and Madeline like to run that O, and the Cornell polls are all across it, and they probably talk about it all year and think about it and whatever. And, you know, not every match was built the same, and that's why, you know, Andy Shea had his group prepared to defend when Princeton went to Yale and almost won, even though I think Yale's quite average this year, if not below average. And, you know, it kind of speaks to why I said it's really hard to go 6-0 in that league. But I still think Princeton's good. I will say this, and to point the finger at one person in particular, like, CJ Kirst elevated that program over the top last season. I think for Princeton to dogpile, number two has to be better. Like, he has to be a dude. And now, it's little things, right? If he scores to make it 12-11 from 8 yards on the righty half wall and doesn't shoot high into that stick, maybe this is a different conversation we're having, right? But I do think he has another gear. Like, I think he can be special. And 51, to now point the other direction, I really think he's elevating. Over the last month, he's gotten a lot better, and he's dodging harder and getting into difficult places. I mean, that you know, dodging to his offhand righty, and then that that like wraparound over the shoulder to far pipe. I mean, that's like a thing of beauty, right? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing I'll say is that they're both juniors, right?
Yep.
And again, like, not to continue to reference this, but there's a reason. And it's because senior offensive players win championships. And if it's not Joey Spallina right now, I'm not sure that we know who it is. It might be Aiden O'Neill. Is he a senior? You know, so even if Nick Abiri doesn't rise to that level this year, there's nothing saying that he won't next year. And, you know, it's because T.J. Kearse didn't win as a junior. You know what I mean? For as special as he was. And if William Firth does, then that means he's particularly special, especially given the fact that he did it in the shadow of C.J. Kearse's graduation. Let's finish in Chapel Hill, where I think my favorite highlight of the weekend was I'm blanking on Army's goalie's name. Anybody in a position to help me out? He's really good. He's from Georgia. Well, he threw a 70-yard pass.
Harry doesn't even know your name, brother.
Get out of here.
Appreciate it, man. Bod and fly.
Threw like a 70-yard
Sean Byrne,
I guess, that got deflected, and it was my favorite goal of the week.
Sean Byrne.
Sean, congratulations on your goal. It was awesome. I got a text from a well-known Inside the Cross contributor whose name I won't say because I'm not sure whether or not he wants this take out in the public associated with him yet. But he predicted that Carolina is going to make it to the Final Four, as is Harvard, because Harvard's first midfield and Carolina's second midfield are the two hardest midfield units to guard in all of college lacrosse. And I think when you watched exactly what this is how you know it's getting late in the podcast, because I'm forgetting Gary Merrill's name as well. When you saw Gary Merrill score a hat trick and realized exactly, you know, why he was so highly touted, and see Anthony Rayo come on. And I actually thought one of the kind of hidden plays of the game was an incredible pick that Luke Bear set in order to set up one of Merrill's goals. You can start to put a little bit more weight on that take, especially as Caden Harshbarger comes back and combines with Mason Sushek in order to form the spine of that first midfield. Carolina, you know, they still don't look like a perfect team to me, but at the same time, I can understand the enthusiasm.
I agree on the perfect team take. I also think, to give credit for transitions, we did a really good job setting up the template for what could kill Carolina, which is they're going to have freshman midfielders dodging with the rock in tournament play late. Like,
yeah,
they are dynamic, they're athletic, but they are young and they feel young. Like, I don't really know why, because Duffy and Petro and some of their defensive midfield depth is all quite old, but something about like the way they play offense, it feels as if a lot of their low razor initiation is done by young, really young players. So I want to give Carolina credit too, though. This feels like a year where people are like waiting and hoping that they're going to get their doors blown off, and everyone's going to be able to say like, oh, there's Carolina again. I mean, they're good. I mean, they're rock solid. And Army is not a team you want at home on a Saturday. Like, they are the definition of a trap game. Like, they play really together, tough off the ground. I mean, our literal government is paying to like make them war machine weapons. Like, it's, you know, they aren't becoming investment bank analysts that, you know, in West Point. So it's Army is still my number one for the Patriot League. I've actually been surprised that they've struggled throughout the middle of their schedule. This was, I think, them elevating to more what their mean should be, right? And I think in a wide open Patriot League, I think Plunkett is probably the best player in that league.
He's so good.
He's awesome. Like, he's such a great two-way threat and like does everything the right way. And it's very rare when like your most dynamic dodger would also probably be your best short 60 midfielder.
Correct.
But he feels he feels that way. Like, you know,
he's the type of guy who is just ashamed that we're not going to see, regardless of what his pro career looks like, his service commitment will mitigate what it could have been. And that's just such a bummer, because to me, like, you know, I say this about Brendan Mundorf all the time, like, you know, guys that probably never, you could just tell that they had more, even though they had great college careers, when they were done, they still had more. And Evan Plunkett, for me, is just like the prototypical, you know, in terms of this class, guy for me.
Yep. Yeah, that's well said. All right, so I'm very, very fascinated to see some of these ACC matchups and see where Carolina shakes out. And to their credit, they're in a really good position and they control their own destiny.
It's interesting watching UNC's offense. We talk about how young they are. To me, and I'll put them right up with Princeton's first half performance against Rutgers. Like, when they're on, they look truly unstoppable. It's just, how quickly can they get to a level where they're sustaining consistent, 15 to 17 goal outputs? And honestly, my big takeaway, will assume that Harvard is going to beat Boston, even though that's kind of the wacky game, just with it being the rivalry, you know, fight for the Boston Harvard deal. This Harvard UNC game is like appointment television, and I'm so curious how Coach Byrne is going to draw up a game plan to dismantle North Carolina's really, really fun offense. To me, UNC's offense is kind of like the traditional, it's the best version of no gimmick, great athletes, great players, good decision making. And, when they're on, I don't know how you stop them, but we'll see how much their youth, their youth can learn. But man,
I think what's so interesting too, just on the Duffy point quick, if you had told me before the year Carolina's 8-1, I would have thought Duffy has like 60 points at this point. Like, he's actually been contained is probably the wrong term, but there are games, you know, the way we hold Joyce Bellina accountable at times, like, there are games where Duffy blending in is not right. Like, he does a lot more than that, and I think he's quite good. But, you know, he'll have, like, 1 and 2, and it'll be like a freshman midfielder dodging every possession. So it's just kind of interesting. Like, considering the type of season Carolina's having, you would think that he would be exploding to like the front of the conversation for the Toronto, and he really it hasn't felt that way to me at least. But yeah, to your point, Nick, I think it'll be really interesting. I don't know. It'll be fascinating to see how quickly Jerry decides to go to some of these young mids, or is he going to trust his defense and his goalie and try and make them shoot offhanded? That is the question. And time will tell.
Well, that's a great note to end on, because I'm probably going to go to that game, which is next Sunday at 1 o'clock, neutral site, Corgan Sports Live. You guys might have heard about that last week. They did a stream that garnered some attention. So, yeah, we're going to have to record after I get home from that. So hopefully it's a good game and we got a lot to talk about.
By the way, the outcome of that scandal is like the funniest thing ever, which is he thought he was making the call and he was just talking to himself. Like, yes. That would happen to us all.
Like, and I'd handle it the same way. I would log on to Twitter and say, I did it. Me, yes. me.
Yep. Yeah. Great. Perfect.
I hope I'm in a position like that one day.
Well, Nick, I will say this, you know, might have been your best episode yet. And in keeping with the recording, because you heard that he Venmo'd somebody $16, right? Because he said many, many times that he actually Venmo'd somebody $16. I love the idea of the three-minute non-releasable Nick Ocello NIL deal, and we're going to bring that to fruition. So if that's the one contribution you made to this show, you can hold your head up high.
I would endow that. Like, I'll endow that thesis. I'm happy to
I will tell you what. I'm probably going to send some texts out and just being like, hey, guys, we're starting a fund. And if I get 10 guys, each chipping in $20 a week, and then it just keeps rolling. I mean, there's – shit, when I was in college, I probably would have done that.
To be clear, we're not trying to incentivize guys delivering these hits. We're just trying to soften the blow after they do. And this is, I know that like the tone of voice there suggested that I was asking a question. I wasn't. I was stating for the audience's benefit, we are not incentivizing players to commit 3-minute non-releasable penalties. Nick is trying to soften the blow figuratively and metaphorically.
Well, we would never do that.
80% of those are just flagged for hitting too hard anyways. So they're not actually like elbow to the head, cheap, dirty. Only the ones Ocello used to commit.
Yeah, it's a tax refund on the tax that the game has gotten soft, and we're gonna do everything we can to combat that. We do not condone helmet to helmet hits, but if it's a good shoulder to the chest that gets a 3-minute non-releasable, you get the kitty.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of the Tailgate Podcast. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review, hit Nick Acella's Venmo, and we'll be back next week with more Tailgate Podcast.
Love you, Terry.
Love you, Nick.
Love you, Larkin.
We're real.